Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to The Writer's Block with Jim Christina and Bobby Bell, right here on LA Talk Radio.
I have seen the wind tossing wild stallions' manes, waving grasses on the plains, wiping tracks out of the dust. I've seen the wind shaking aspens in the fall, spinning windmills in a squall, rattling fences full of rust. I've seen the wind. I've seen wind, so undefined in many ways, on stormy nights and sunny days, like foggy memories of a dream. Things aren't always what they seem in the wind.
Welcome to the Writer's Block. We are so excited to have you with us tonight. This is co-host Bobby Jean Bell, and that opening song is by a friend of mine, Bernadette Ducharme. I've seen the wind, and it seemed really appropriate for tonight's show. We have with us Craig Johnson. He is the New York Times bestselling author of the Longmire Mysteries, the basis for the hit Netflix original series Longmire. He is the recipient of the Western Writers of America Spur Award for Fiction, and his novella Spirit of Steamboat was the first One Book Wyoming selection. He lives in Ucross, Wyoming, with a population of 25. And I believe, Craig, if I'm not mistaken, that it is windy in Wyoming. Welcome.
No, that's a falsehood. We have no wind here in Wyoming at all. There's just none at all, none whatsoever. That's a pretty funny story about that. I was up on the Northern Cheyenne Reservation with a good friend of mine, Charles Little, old man, who's a tribal elder, he was up there, and there was a group of photographers with us for a magazine article, and the wind, it's the Wyoming-Montana border, so the wind was blowing at about, 40 miles an hour or something, and, Charles is about 93 years old, his pigtails were sticking out of the back of his head, straight out of the back of his head, and these poor guys that were doing the photography and everything were freezing to death, and they finally looked at him and said, "Oh, it's beautiful up here, but how do you get used to the wind?" And Charles just looks at him and goes, "What wind?" Kind of gives you an idea what the Cheyenne, Northern Cheyenne sense of humor is like. But we refer to this as the UCLA area. That's Ucross, Claremont, Leiter, and Arvada. And Ucross is the crown jewel of the UCLA area. And we're right now, I think we're kind of like the epicenter of social distancing. It was only 25 people in probably about, 15-mile radius But it's a pretty nice place. It gives me a solitude, and it gives me a focus that enables me to read and also to write.
Well, we are so delighted to have you back. This, I think, is your third time. And I know that our host, Jim Christina, who's not able to be with us tonight by voice, he sends you his very best and regrets that he's not able to be here, but assures me he is listening from his home in Idaho.
I understood that Jim was hungover. That's why I wasn't able to be on the show tonight. Was that the case? Supposed to mention that on the air? I'm sorry. Not supposed to say that?
You must be a fiction. You must be a fiction writer.
Stranger than truth, No, I hope he starts feeling better. I'm sorry to miss him, but I hope he's feeling better.
Well, we're just so excited to have you with us tonight. We just didn't want to delay the opportunity. It's been a while since you've been with us. I think the last time might have been around the publication of Western Star. So tell us a little bit about maybe what's been going on in your life since then. And then we're going to talk a little bit about Land of Wolves, but sort of what's been going on with you.
Oh, I mean, you know, for me, like, you know, my life is kind of, you know, subjugated to Walt Longmire's life, like, to a great extent, like that. And, you know, one book a year, like that. And then I always try and, like, knock out a few novellas, like, you know, and short stories, you know, with Walt's life. And then some other projects, too, like that, that I've been working on, like that. But yeah, you know, for me, you know, it always is going to come back to Walt, like that. I really enjoy writing the Walt books. I mean, I guess, you know, if I had, you know, if I were to be honest, when the first book came out, The Cold Dish, like at, when Viking Penguin picked it up, they asked me, they said, well, what do you think? We really like these characters. We really like this place. We think that readers are going to want more of this world. And would you think about, you know, writing, you know, some more of these, like it? And, you know, that's when I, with the knowledge of only having written one book, you know, said, no, I don't really think so. I don't think that's a good idea. But I've got some other ideas I want to bounce off you guys. Like, and Catherine Court, who was the president of Penguin at that period in time and a senior editor at Viking, you know, she said, you know, maybe you should go back to Wyoming and think about this, you know, before you make a hasty decision about it, like that. And, you know, for me, a lot of it came down to the fact that, you know, it really was almost like, you know, whenever you finish a novel, certainly when it's not a series, it's almost like a mass death. You know, I mean, all of those mm-hmm. characters are gone, mm-hmm. and, you know, you really don't have them anymore. And so, you know, that was kind of a psychological, you know, tribulation to kind of have to go through, like that. And I thought, you know, well, you know, with these characters, you know, what more do they have more stories to tell? That was the big question. And, you know, the answer came roaring back that, yeah, they had a lot of other stories to tell. And I just had to be, you know, brave enough to try and tell them. But, you know, whenever you're doing something like that, you know, the big bugaboo, the big, you know, big monster in the room, like that, is always going to be, you know, you don't want to be repetitious. You don't want to be, you know, on a treadmill, you know, doing formula books like that, where you're doing the mm-hmm. same things over and over and over again. And so, you know, I knew that, you know, working with Viking Penguin, that they would give me the kind of freedom that I needed to be able to, you know, make sure that each book was going to be a different entity unto itself. Because anything else is kind of an artistic death like that. And so, you know, you really want to try and do something different with every book. And so then the question became, okay, well, would there be a readership for a series of books where, you know, each book is, you know, very different, you know, from all of the others? And as it turns out, you know, I've been extraordinarily fortunate like that. And there have been, like, a lot of really wonderful readers that, you know, have kind of tagged along with me on this trail, you know, that I've been blazing mm-hmm. with Walt, like, to try and do something a little bit different. The book that you mentioned, you know, the Western Star, came out, I believe, I think that's been like 3 or 4 years ago, like that. And it was like a retelling, you know, of Agatha Christie's Murder on the Orient Express, which was something, you know, new to attempt, you know. And that one kind of came to be because, you know, I was talking to a sheriff here in Wyoming, and he told me that, oh, yeah, the Wyoming Sheriff's Association used to have their meeting on a train, like that went back and forth across the state, you know. And I thought, a whole trainload of sheriffs, you know, that just sounds like an opportunity to me. And so that's how the Western Star kind of came to be, like that. And it kind of led into, you know, the Depth of Winter, like that, which was, you know, a kind of an epic, you know, south of the border, you know, storyline for Walt, which was something, once again, you know, very, very different from anything that I'd done before. And then, of course, you know, Western Star, last year's book, you know, which was once again an attempt to try and do something a little bit different. I feel like, you know, as a writer, you know, you kind of have to stretch yourself and try and do something a little bit different. And luckily, you know, if you're fortunate enough to have good readers that'll follow along with you, then you can continue, you know, publishing those books and writing them and continue to blaze that kind of a trail.
Well, you know, when I picked up Land of Wolves several days ago to prepare for tonight, of course, you know, you always get me from the very first sentence, and the wind was in the very first sentence of this book. And this song of Bernadette's just, you know, I sent it to Jim like immediately. I maybe had read one paragraph of the book, and I said, what do you think about the music to start the show? Land of Wolves, I had not read the book before it that you just mentioned, Depth of Winter, in this, because you are writing a series, you do set it up so that we don't need to necessarily have read, you know, every book. You make a lot of references to Depth of Winter in this, in Land of Wolves, they must have happened one book shortly after the other, and which is typical for you. There's not a lot of time, it seems, between the books. And it makes me want to read Depth of Winter because the references that Walt makes and others to what went on in that book, I can't wait to pick that one up, even though I didn't need to read it to fully be engrossed in Land of Wolves. And I think you kind of do that with each one, don't you?
Oh, yeah. I think that's a responsibility, that you have. There are going to be people that, like I was mentioning, like the loyal readers that have, been with you for, 15, 20, 30 years. And then you have to be respectful, of the readers that, wander into a bookstore and look down and see the cover of that book and mm-hmm. and say, maybe I'll give that a try. You don't want to alienate that kind of a reader like that by being so, confined with the amount of information that you bring to the table. I mean, yeah, you do want to have that through line where, all of these books, people will always ask me, they'll always say, well, if I start reading your books, where should I start? And I'm like, well, you can jump in anywhere like that because, right. That is a responsibility that you have that each book, each novel should have, be an entity unto itself like that, so that someone can read that book, and really get a sense of the characters and the place, and a good, strong sense of story and plot like that. And history and humor and all of those things too, like that. But, the book should be able to stand on its own each time like that. But then again, it's also nice to be able to draw, from all those previous books, that mm-hmm. breadth of information, on character and place and, be able to draw from that to have a deeper well like that to kind of go into. And, whenever you have something as epic, as Depth of Winter happened to Walt, I mean, it really is a kind of an epic adventure that he has, down there in Mexico and kind of pushes him out on the envelope there, a lot further than, we've been before like that. Then, the reverberations of that, have to be able to, to resound, through the following books. And, he's got to get back, from where he was to do what it is that he had to do. Down in Mexico like that. And that's really a lot of what Land of Wolves is about. I mean, the symbolism of the book, of course, is that there's a wolf, mm-hmm. There in the Bighorn Mountains, that's come over from the Lamar Valley, in Yellowstone like that, and we do have, wolves that do make that trip and suddenly appear, in the Bighorn Mountains, kind of strangers in a strange land. And in many ways, that's the metaphor for the book in the sense that, Walt has kind of become a stranger in his own land, doesn't recognize his home mm-hmm. anymore, like that, after the things that happened to him. And he's got to kind of work his way back, try to rejoin a society that maybe has kind of, kicked him out. And that's kind of the same thing that's happened to this wolf, like that, and, the difficulties that he runs into, in trying to reassimilate himself into that society and into that culture, like that, are a lot of what the book is about.
You start.
And, yeah, you did mention one of the important things to the books is that, when I was starting out like that night, I started thinking about writing a series of books. I'd read other series of books like that. And one of the things that kind of annoyed me whenever I would read a series of books was, I'd read a book and then I'd pick up the next book and it would be 2 years later in the characters' lives. And I'd be like, well, what were they for the 2 years? And how come I didn't hear about it? And, I want to know about that. If I really, yeah. Enjoy a character and really enjoy that world, then I want to know. And so, for me, I decided that I would do something where it would be, the biggest things, that have a large scale effect on us in the American West, other than the wind, are, of course, the seasons. I mean, the weather is, such mm-hmm. a large scale effect, on who we are and what we are. And so I decided that, for me, it would be important for Walt to have those seasons, to have a season of four books, to get Walt, through a year in his life like that. Well, consequently, that provided me with a couple of advantages in the sense that, Walt, each book is only a couple of months, mm-hmm. Apart, from each book. And, that kind of gives me a really strong continuity in the sense that, whatever happened in the previous book is going to have reverberations in the following books, maybe one or two or three or who knows, maybe all of the books. The other thing that it did for me, which, I really hadn't planned on, which was, kind of a surprise, was it kind of slowed Walt's aging to be honest with you. You know, I mean, Walt kind of starts out, you know, as a Vietnam veteran in The Cold Dish. Like, and so he's, you know, he's not a spring chicken, you know, whenever the books start out. And so, you know, it's kind of interesting to me that, you know, to be, you know, more than 12 books down the road, we're only, you know, maybe 3 years later than we were when we first met Walt. And so, you know, it kind of slowed down the aging process for Walt, which allows me to have him hang around for maybe a little bit longer, which I have to admit is very reassuring to me because I kind of enjoy his company, I have to admit.
This book, you do start with a couple of quotes. One of them you just said, "A land of strangers is a land of wolves." And you also write a really interesting acknowledgement in the beginning. You had some interaction with a wolf as a young man. And I wondered if you might just, again, what inspires a book? Obviously, your interaction with a wolf had something to do with putting this book together. Do you want to chat about that for a moment?
Oh, sure. Yeah. I mean, you know, and for me, like, you know, a lot of, you know, the joy of writing books, of course, is, you know, a lot of the research that goes into them. And, you know, I mean, you know, I knew I was going to have to be an expert on wolves like that, you know, whenever I sat down to write this book. Like, it's a very controversial issue, you know, in the American West. Mm-hmm. There are many people that are pro-wolf. There are many people that are anti-wolf. Like, and so I knew this was going to kind of be a hot topic issue, you know, for me to take on. And so I better make sure that I knew what it was that I was talking about. But, you know, of all the research that you do, and of course, my favorite source of research is always to go buy books.
Yeah.
Because I'm a reader and I love buying books. And I love reading books, you know, and so I had, you know, I've always got stacks and stacks, you know, of research material up in my loft, you know, where it is that I write. But then again, I also know that, you know, the seminal material many times will come from, you know, personal, you know, interaction, you know, and things that have happened to me personally. And I was actually working at Montana, like as a cowboy and like that, you know, the Dillon area, like that, and stringing fence, like that, and had an interaction with a wolf like that, who was curious. I was in a very far-flung area, you know, on a ridgeline way, way, way far away from any other, you know, human beings like that. And this wolf would come up on this ridge like in the tree line there and watch me as I was, like, repairing fence line. And it was very curious to me like that because, you know, I mean, I was armed, you know, and everything, but I never felt threatened by that wolf like that. It just was curious as to, you know, who I was and why I was there and what I was doing. And it's always been interesting to me like that because an awful lot of, like, you know, what you read about wolves, like, you know, that these slathering beasts that are out there, you know, hiding behind the trees, just waiting, you know, to go for your throat. And that's really not been my experience, you know, with wolves. My experience with wolves is they're almost like ghosts. You know, you if you're lucky enough to see them in the wild, you know, you'll see them just in a fleeting instant, you know, between the trees, like, and they'll just disappear, and you'll have seen them once, you know, in the wild in your life, like that. And so it's really kind of a wonderful kind of experience like that. And, you know, I remember, you know, finishing up with that job like that and hoping that I would see that wolf, you know, for that one last day that I was in that area, you know, fixing the fence line on that ridge, like that. And she disappeared like that. She didn't come back like that day. And it was, you know, always a little bit of sadness for me that I never got to wave goodbye to that wolf like that and say goodbye to it like that. But, yeah, I mean, that's the experience that I've had is that they're very knowledgeable. They have to be very, you know, cautious, you know, around human beings like that. And, you know, just it's a, you know, a connection that we made, you know, thousands and thousands of years ago, you know, whenever that first, you know, Cro-Magnon, you know, or Neanderthal, like, you know, threw a, you know, an oily, you know, caribou leg on the outside and the outskirts of a fire like that and lured that first wolf in like that, a companionship like that and a partnership, you know, that made us, you know, much better hunters than we really were. And, you know, even though we're primates, you know, an awful lot of, you know, what we've learned, you know, from our society, from our abilities to hunt, an awful lot of things like that have formulated a lot of human beings came from our partnership, you know, with those wolves like that. And, you know, I think that's something that, you know, you need to be respectful of like that and look back and see as maybe a turning point in our species.
There are some characters that do return in this book, and then and then there are, of course, a variety of new characters. We don't see him drinking quite as much beer in this book, but we, you know, Lucian comes back. Of course, Vic is there. Henry Standing Bear plays a role, but he's not as significant, but has an important. He and Walt have some conversations. One sort of about Walt getting himself reestablished after what happened in Mexico. And Henry Standing Bear says to him, you know, it sounds like, what does he say? It sort of sounds like you're getting ready for a vision. And then he also shares some information about, you know, does provide some information about wolves. And we get the Mallow Cup cards and Virgil White Buffalo kind of return to the story. It was so fun how you reintroduce things, even if you don't spend a lot of time as the author, it helps us reconnect, you know. There we are at the Red Pony, you know, and it's like, oh, I know that space, you know, or the fact that Henry Standing Bear doesn't really use contractions, you know, when he speaks. It's just really fun. You almost feel like, oh, I'm in that place. Oh, yeah, I know exactly where that is.
Well, that's one of the big things. Like, I'm always telling writing students, like, you know, that, you know, whenever you're sitting down to write a novel, in many ways, it's almost like conducting a choral group. Each one of the characters and each one of the voices of those characters is there for a specific reason. They're there to give voice, you know, to an important perspective or an important, you know, piece of knowledge like that, that you're going to carry through within that novel. And, you know, to have an ensemble of characters, you know, that you can bring back is always a great joy. And the other thing I'm always telling, you know, the students also is that, you know, voice is an extraordinarily important aspect, you know, to the writing process. It's overlooked a great deal of the time because it's one of those things that, you know, maybe isn't quite as sexy as this, you know, physical description or something like that, you know, but it's something that's, you know, going to be more important in the long run. I mean, what I tell students is that generally you get to describe a character once in a novel. You get to describe them one time. And, you know, it better not be, you know, a 4-page description of a character. It better be, you know, the pith and the marrow. It better be what it is that we need to know about that character from the physicality like that. But that character is going to speak all the way through that novel. So for my money, in many ways, you know, the voice of the character is infinitely more important than, you know, the physicality. The physicality will come and go, but that voice will be there all the way through. Mm-hmm. And, you know, one of the biggest mistakes that I see with a lot of young authors is that, you know, they don't really, you know, do a differentiation of that. Like an awful lot of the time, they, you know, the characters sound an awful lot alike. And mm-hmm. you really have to find a way to, you know, differentiate, like to give them, you know, that separation of voice that they so desperately need, whether it's a gender, whether it's a race, whether it's an age, whether it's, you know, all of these different things that are going to have an effect, you know, on the character of that voice, you know, the words that they use, the cadence of their voices, like at the humor that they use, like that is always an essential part, you know, for me. I'm always, you know, I stunned whenever I read a book and there's absolutely no humor in that book at all.
Mm-hmm.
I'm, for me, that's an essential part of like who these characters are, you know, and who people are. Like, what is their sense of humor? How do they use it? You know, and how does it display itself in so many ways is so revealing, you know, of who that character is. You know, it's difficult, you know, because sometimes, you know, people will say, well, yeah, if I'm not funny, then what do I do? And I'm always like, well, you're in kind of deep trouble then, aren't you? Like, generally, everybody has a sense of humor, like, and, you know, and it's not like it has to be spontaneous. It's not like it has to be improvisational, because we are authors, like we're novel, we're novelists, and we're, writing, we're sitting in a room by ourselves, typing about our imaginary friends. And so, how many times, do you come out of a situation and think, oh, I wish I had said this, or I wish this had been said, so I could have said this. Well, that's the wonderful thing, about being an author, is that you have the opportunity to be able to set those kind of situations up and, and utilize, instances, where that humor comes from like that. But I think that that's an essential part of the whole process, though, to be able to, give those characters a voice like that. And when you do have, like I said, an ensemble, it makes that a lot easier to do because you, have that opportunity to draw those characters back and bring them back. There is an ebb and a flow, I think, whenever you're writing a series of books, you can get into trouble when you try and have the same amount of the same characters in every novel. There are obviously, certain books, where, you're going to have a tool set, with those characters that you can utilize. In Land of Wolves, there was a character, Santiago Cesar Victoria, who I needed to bring back, and have be a large part of that particular storyline simply because there's so much Basque in that particular book. We have a very large percentage of Basque peoples here, in the Bighorn Mountains in Wyoming. And, this was a major aspect of this storyline. And so I knew that he was going to be, come roaring back, in this particular book. And then also, Vic, I knew Vic was going to be a real strong character in this particular book just simply because, Walt needed some humor, to kind of bring him back. Mm-hmm. And she's a character that I can, count on, to give me a lot of humor, whenever it is that I need it. But that's kind of the fun, that you get the opportunity to bring those characters back and utilize the strong suits that they have, to do what it is that you need to do, in each one of those books. I mean, the two emails that I get, subsequently after a book comes out are, the two emails I get will be, A, you beat up on Walt too much in this book. You need to take it easy on him on the next one and be a little easier on him on the next book. And then, which is always, very gratifying like that, because that means that people are very, connected, to this character, and they really want him to be okay. And then the other one was, there was not enough of my favorite character in his name here. Whether it's like there was not enough Henry, or there wasn't enough Lucian, or there wasn't enough Vic. And I knew I'd reach a certain point in the books whenever I started getting emails where people were saying there really wasn't enough dog in the last book. And so, this was an opportunity, with this particular book, to have dog, play a much larger role in this one, too.
And he does. And he does.
And it changes the landscape. It changes the landscape of the books and gives you something different to work with every time.
We're going to just take a quick break, Craig. And Ronan, if you could, if you're listening, could we hear a little bit about LA Talk Radio? See if Ronan can put that on for us.
Hi, Jim Christina, your host for The Writer's Block, right here on LA Talk Radio. And this is just a reminder that while everybody's locked down with this COVID-19, working from home, getting bored, you do have an option, and that option is to go to www.latalkradio.com. See, as a .com, we've got it all, from music, sports, self-help. Hell, we even have talk. So why don't you tune in during the day while you're working and listen to what our great hosts and great shows have to say. And just a reminder, Thursday night, 7 p.m. Pacific, is the Writer's Block, brought to you by LA Talk Radio. So have yourselves a great time, stay safe out there, and remember, latalkradio.com.
And we're back speaking with Craig Johnson. It's so much fun. Craig, does when you're writing a scene, do the characters ever surprise you? I mean, does Walt ever want to do something that you don't anticipate that he's going to want to do?
Oh, I think that's, an essential part of the process, to be honest. I'm a big one for formatting. I'm a big one for outlines. I kind of tend to refer to what I write as socially responsible crime fiction. Whenever I'm writing a book, I'm not just looking to turn pages and stack up bodies like cordwood. Most generally, I've got some sort of a social issue or message, that I want to get across in a book. And I think it's important, I don't think you can just leave that, to chance whenever you're writing a book. So I write very structured outlines, before I sit down and write the books. Uh-huh. But that doesn't mean that there won't be, some kind of magical, improvisational moment events that'll come along. I mean, there's a reason for that. You know, I mean, I think that you can write a wonderful, you know, essay, you know, and write a wonderful outline, you know, and accomplish everything that you wanted to do in that book by the time you get to the end, you know, but something magical should probably happen. Something should happen along the way. If you accomplish everything you had in your outline but nothing else, you probably failed in writing that novel, you know, because, you know, a novel in many ways is kind of like taking a trip, you know, to some place you've never been. And, you know, for me, you know, that part of the joy of a trip is, you know, to not be staring at the odometer like that, but more importantly, you know, to be looking out there at the scenery and seeing what other opportunities, you know, might be along the way. And, you know, those improvisational moments are something that I think as you get more comfortable as a writer, you know, you when you're first starting out, you're very loath, you know, to step out into the thin ice of getting away from, you know, your outline. You're like, I have my outline. I'm going to stay with my outline. It's like a life preserver. You don't want to, like, you know, be out there in the ocean swimming around treading water. You know, you want to, like, you know, have that float with you all the time like that. But, you know, as you get a little bit more comfortable, you know, with the process, you know, and you feel like your swimming abilities, you know, are maybe a little bit stronger, and you can take care of yourself in the currents and, you know, not turn into a little bit of flotsam and jetsam along the way like that, then you become a little bit more open to the idea that maybe it would be okay to, like, you know, explore some of those ideas that happen along the way. Because I guarantee you that, like, you may think that you know what a novel is about when you first start out, but something's probably going to happen along the way. You're going to learn things along the way, along with those characters, you know, and they'll inform you, you know, as you go along, like, and let you know that, you know, maybe there are some other options here and that you should be open to those things. And I don't think that, you know, you hear a lot of authors, it gets, you know, a little wooey after a while, like that, where they talk about, you know, well, the characters just talk to me and they go off and they do their own thing. And I'm not a big believer in that. I mean, you're the only one in the room most generally, like that. And generally what happens is it's a pretty scientific, you know, reason for that, you know, and what it is, it's your subconscious mind is what it is. I mean, your conscious mind is what it is responsible for the outlines and doing the research and having the fingers, you know, on the keyboard and all of that, you know, but, you know, your subconscious mind is kind of fluid and it's kind of moving in and out, you know, with that process, you know, and it's aware of all the things that your conscious mind is concerned with. But then again, it also might do a little daydreaming and might, like, explore some areas that maybe you haven't, you know, considered all that much. And you know, it might come in, you know, with some things. And so, like any other backseat driver, while you're out there, you know, in one of these, you know, these attempts to, you know, do the journey that is a novel, it's going to do what every other backseat driver does and kind of toss some comments, you know, over the seat. Like, and it doesn't have its hand on the steering wheel or the gas or the brake like that, but that doesn't mean it can't, you know, make some commentary along the way.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, you get used to the idea that, you know, maybe you should listen to those. Because sometimes those are the treasure troves, you know, that you can, you know, kind of glean from a story like that maybe you weren't aware of before.
It was kind of fun that you you introduced the computer to Walt.
Yeah, that's not smooth sailing. Like that was kind of a rough situation for poor Walt to have to kind of contend with. Like that, but that actually came from a sheriff, actually a dispatcher who worked for a sheriff's department here in Wyoming, and she explained to me that, you know, she would have to print out her sheriff's emails and leave them on his desk so that he could handwrite the responses, and then she would take them back in and then type them in and answer his emails for him. Like, and I thought, boy, I don't know if Ruby would put up with that for very long. Like, you know, and so I thought, okay, this is going to, you know, this is going to be a conflict. This is going to be a dramatic conflict for these characters for them to kind of have to come to terms with. Like that. And so Walt does have to try and learn how to use a computer after all of these years. Look at it. And it's not only a source of irritation, but a great source of humor, I think. You know,
it was. Yeah.
Whenever Walt answers his first email and he announces to Ruby, I just answered my first email, and she's like, "We are all so proud of you, Walt." You know, he's slowly but surely making his way, you know, into the 20th, not even the 21st century, but the 20th century.
Yeah, his questions like, what's a server, you know, and I imagine that server to him would have a whole lot of
No, he's having a hard time. Like, it's very, very difficult for him to kind of understand, you know, how all of this works. Like, and he's kind of an old dog, you know. It's kind of hard for him to learn some of these new tricks, you know. And that for me is, you know, one of the joys of it too. Like, I mean, you have to be honest, you know, with your characters. You know, I mean, you know, the old adage is that, you know, we like people, you know, for their virtues, but we love them for their faults. Mm-hmm. It's the things that are wrong with characters, the things that are their shortcomings, you know, that make them interesting. I'm always reminding, you know, writing students about that. You know, you can tell me all the strengths of your character, you know, in a couple of seconds, but tell me what's wrong with them. Tell me what's, you know, what it is that drives them. An awful lot of the time, you know, those strengths, you know, the strengths of your characters and the strengths of the individual, they tend to come from the weaknesses. You know, they're trying to solve some things, you know, that they've, you know, trying to come to terms with, like, and you know, that those things are, you know, very much entwined, it seems to me.
There was a piece of old technology that I thought was so interesting. It's kind of near the end of the book, and they're working with a witness who captured a driver's license number, and he goes to a little yellow book, and, you know, Vic is and she's biting at the bit, like, just give me the number, because, you know, she knows how fast, and he's going back and forth through these pages, and I had to believe that there was such a thing. You wouldn't make that up. There must have been such a kind of cross-reference directory. That was so interesting.
Yeah, I you know, they used to have these little cross-reference directories, you know, and I can't remember if it was the Elks Club or the Lions. I believe it was the Lions Club, I believe is what it was. And they had these, like, directories that they sold, you know, and they were like a dollar. And they would have, like, you know, everybody in the counties, you know, phone, they'd have their license plate number, and then they would have their name, and then they would have their address, and then they would have their phone number. And they sold these for like a dollar next to the cash register of, you know, just about every, you know, store in, you know, in the county. And, you know, I mean, nowadays that would be such an invasion of privacy.
Yeah.
And, you know, an opportunity like that, you know, for, you know, some real mayhem out there, you know, in the modern era. But yeah, no, they had those booklets, and they, you know, sold them for a dollar a piece. Like, and it was, of course, you know, for the Lions Club, like, it, I believe it was for blind children, like, it, you know, it's obviously for a good cause, but yeah, definitely not politically correct and not something that you would have nowadays. Like, but yeah, it turns out to be a kind of a key aspect, you know, for, you know, finding out who it is that might have done something, and where this individual might be, or who it is that they might be. And so it's always interesting to me to kind of use some of the older technology that's kind of still floating around, like, and this old guy has that one of those books right there by his phone.
That's so funny.
Right there by the door, like, so in case he sees somebody drive by, he can, like, look and see who that is, like, you know, because we've got license plate numbers here in Johnson County, Wyoming, that have been held by the same families for like 50 years, 50 years, 70 years, like,
yeah.
And so a lot of those license plate numbers haven't changed.
I'm going to just do another quick ad, and then we're going to be right back. Here we go. Readers want the book we're talking about tonight, Land of Wolves by Craig Johnson, or any of the Writer's Block featured authors? Easy. One-stop shopping. Support independent booksellers when you purchase books at, now you got to write this down, www.bookshop.org/shop/Out West Shop. Click the Writer's Block book list for recent titles that include the podcast link to the interview. Browse our other categories, U.S. history, film, music, American West, cooking, tools for writers, biography, fiction, art, and more, including children's books. Visit the Writer's Block radio show or Out West Shop Facebook pages for our Today's Picks selections. Four simple steps to support authors and booksellers. Shop, open the package, read, and repeat. And remember, it's always a great day out west. And we're back with Craig Johnson. Craig, as I'm looking at the clock, so we always ask the question, do you get writer's block? If so, what do you do about it? And if you don't, what do you think about it?
I think that it doesn't exist. you know, maybe I'm just fortunate. You know, I should probably knock on some wood or knock on my head really quickly like that. But, I'm just not a big believer in it. I think that's just a writer talking themselves out of writing. You know, one of the big things for me, of course, like it is that I do outline. And that's not sexy. That's not fun. It's just drudgery work. You know, it's like digging the foundation for a house. It's not the fun part. It's not the fixtures and the interior decorating or anything like that. It's digging a hole. Like that. And and that's kind of what, you know, whenever you're putting together an outline for a book, it's not very fun like that. The only thing is, though, it kind of, you know, gives you opportunities. The first thing that it does is, it gives you a sense of the pacing of a book. You know, whenever you look at the structure of a book, if you're just going to wing it and see where it goes, then you're kind of out there in that ocean I was talking about, without a float or anything. And pacing has always been one of the things that's very, very, very difficult, you know, to try and teach. You really need to get a sense of it. It's one of those things that the more you write, the more you get a sense of that, you know, that idea of what the pacing of a novel is going to be. And one of the great tools in being able to do that is an outline, because if you can look at the structure and see, oh, well, I'm really kind of action heavy at the very beginning of the book, and then there's a major lull for like 120 pages before, you know, something else really kind of happens. Like, well, then it gives you the opportunity to maybe move those pieces of your novel around, like at to kind of make the novel that you want to write, rather than writing a whole novel and then turning around and going, oh my gosh, I've got to rewrite this whole thing, like that, and start from scratch, you know, and move these things around. It's a whole lot easier to rewrite an outline than it is to rewrite an entire novel. The other thing that, you know, that an outline provides is that you always know what's happening next. Mm-hmm. An awful lot of the time, like at whenever writers struggle with writer block, they tend to not know what it is that's happening next, because they've written themselves into a dead end, you know, an alleyway, like at that they don't know where to go to from there. Well, if you do have an outline, you've always got something that tells you, you know, which direction it is you need to go to, or what it is that's going to be happening next, and how you can write towards that. And that for me is always something that, you know, is a handy thing to have, like when you're out there in that vast ocean that stretches as far as the eye can see. The other thing that I've got is I have a ranch. I built my ranch myself. I poured the concrete, stacked the logs, you know, did the plumbing, the electricity, the fencing, the corral, the built the barn, did it all myself. And so there's always something else for me to be doing like that. And sometimes, you know, today I was fighting with irrigation pumps like that. And there's nothing I really hate more than irrigation like that, because it bands together all the major elements of electrical, mechanical, and hydraulic. And I guarantee you, if you get two of those systems to work, the third one will fail. And so it's really just the work of the devil is really what it is like it. And so whenever I'm out there and it's 90 degrees in the sun and I'm fighting, you know, with the irrigation, I got to tell you, sitting on my stool in my loft, you know, there and getting together with Walt and Henry and Vic and Lucian and the dog and Cesar Battori and everybody back in Absaroka County is very appealing. Like, so I never take that time whenever I'm sitting there in front of that computer very lightly like that. I love it, and I look forward to it every single day.
What do you think writing can do that film can't do?
Oh, that's easy. Like, I mean, and you know, and I guess I don't know if I would call myself a combat hardened veteran like that, but after six seasons of Longmire, you know, and it was a wonderful experience like that, you know, and we'll see what happens with the Warner Brothers like that. You know, they've got all the rights, you know, to Longmire like that, and it was a continued success. I mean, the only reason it's not on the air now is simply because Warner Brothers wouldn't sell it to Netflix and wouldn't sell it to A&E, who had it previously. You know, we've had a wonderful experience. We're still one of the top 20 shows, you know, on Netflix, even after being, you know, off the air now for about 2.5 years. So it'll be interesting to see what happens, you know. But we had a really marvelous experience, you know, with the producers and the directors and the actors and everybody that we had. And they still, you know, come to Wyoming, not this year, simply because we're having a virtual Longmire Days on August 13th through the 16th. So that's something to look forward to. You can find us on Facebook and everywhere like that. But you know, that's a little bit of a challenge like that, because, you know, Hollywood is pretty spectacular. I mean, it's amazing what it is that they can do, you know, with all of the things that they have to work with, you know, with all of the scenery, with all of the special effects, with all the magnificent performances like that, and, you know, the qualities of performance that you get, you know, and all of that. But the one thing that they don't have, the one thing that, you know, that's really, really very difficult for Hollywood to compete with is the one tool that all of us authors have in our tool belt that's just maybe the most magical tool that we have. It's called the reader's imagination. I mean, that's basically what we do, like, as authors. We stack up those dominoes, those words. Each one of those words is a domino, and we stack those dominoes up all the way through to the horizon, and then we try and use the right word. Not too many, not too few, but just the one that will kick off that reader's imagination, just mm-hmm. to tip off that first domino, and then you get to watch those falling dominoes go all directions, all the way to the horizon, and they get to do all of your hard work for you.
And we love it.
Oh, they custom fit, you know, I mean, the characters, the place, everything to exactly what it is that they want to see. Uh-huh. And even with the production budgets of, you know, millions and millions of dollars, it's very difficult for Hollywood to compete with that. You know, we get to climb into that reader's mind, and they give us access, you know, to the inner sanctum, one of the most magnificent places in the world, the reader's mind, and climb in there and help us to tell that story. And boy, that's a really great place to go to. I talk about how wonderful it is to go and sit on my chair, you know, at my desk and begin that writing process like that. But the other really wonderful place to go to is the reader's imagination.
With that, we're going to take one more quick ad. And Ronan, let's hear from Creative Edge.
You know, when Creative Edge Publicity was founded in 2016, they immediately showed they weren't the same as other publicity firms. No, they work closely with their individual clients' needs and goals and push harder to get them noticed. Creative Edge believes that communication is an important part of the partnership, and that model is how they have built their success. They collaborate and work with local, national, and international media outlets and organizations to meet their clients' goals and needs. So Creative Edge, it's your brand and your future. Mickey Mickelson, publicist, www.creative-edge.services.
And we're back with our special guest tonight, Craig Johnson. So, Craig, you've got a new book coming out in September with a little bit of time we have left. We want to hear about Next to Last Stand. Oh, my gosh. I'm in love with the cover of it. Tell us about this book.
Well, the first thing I should do is assure everybody that Walt has a nice long life ahead of him. Everybody was kind of scared when the title of the book came out. They said, "You're not going to stop writing Walt, are you?" Like, and I'm like, no. No, the Next to Last Stand has to do with the Battle of the Bighorn, like that, mm-hmm. which is just about maybe an hour up the road from where my ranch is. Like that. And, you know, it's one of those things where, you know, you have different aspects of, you know, of Western history, you know, which is always a strong suit in my books. I really enjoy putting as much history as I can in there. And for me, you know, the interesting part is trying to find something different, something new, mm-hmm. That maybe hasn't been done to death, you know, whenever I try and find something historic in the American West to include in my books. And boy, you know, you would think that just about every single thing that could possibly be gleaned from the Battle of the Little Bighorn, you know, and Custer and you know, Sitting Bull and Crazy Horse, like it, and Reno and Benteen has been gone over. And I got to tell you that, like, you know, with the amount of research that I have done and the amount of books that I have read, you know, about this particular battle and these individuals, like that it's kind of a mountain to climb. Like, the amount of information you have to try and take in is going to be, you know, kind of, you know, daunting in many ways. Like, but This was. I found a bit of information, actually, from some essays that I thought, you know, might be usable like that. And to kind of tell you about this book, I kind of have to give you a little bit of an art history lesson. It may sound kind of strange like that, but there was a painter by the name of Cassili Adams, who I think probably you haven't ever heard of like that, but I can just about guarantee that you've seen his work.
Oh, yes.
there was a painter by the name of Cassili Adams, and about, 10 or 12 years after the Battle of the Little Bighorn in 1876, he did a painting. He was a resident of St. Louis, and he did this painting. It was a 16.5 by 9.5 foot painting that he did, which was called Custer's Last Fight. And at that period in time, it was kind of the rage. You have to remember that this is, before there were any newsreels or, cable television or, 24-hour, news cycles or anything like that. And what they would do is they would hire these painters to do these huge paintings, and then they would tour them, all mm-hmm. over the country. Mm-hmm. And, they would light them and charge people, two bits, to go into the wagon and see this painting. And what it was an opportunity for people to feel as though they had actually seen this moment in history, this celebrated moment in American history. And so Cassili Adams' painting, went on tour and went all over the country and came back to St. Louis And they really didn't have anything to do with the painting They didn't know where to put it or anything. And so there was a saloon keeper near the train station, in St. Louis, and he bought the painting. He bought the painting from Cassili Adams and put it up on the wall in his saloon And there it remained, for about 30 or 40 years. And suddenly as sometimes happens with these types of establishments, this one went bankrupt. It went under. And one of the biggest creditors that they had at that period in time was a then small brewery that was owned by a fellow by the name of Augustus Bush. And he had a little brewery called Budweiser. And he came down there and said, "Well, you owe me $30,000 for the beer. How are you going to pay me?" And they said, "Well, we don't have any money." And he looked, always wanted to see an opportunity. Augie Bush looked up on the wall and saw this big, huge painting and said, "I'll take the painting." So they peeled the painting off the wall. He rolled it under his arm, went back up to the brewery, rolled it out on a big table, and told his marketing and publicity guys, he said, "We're going to make posters of this painting. And we're going to send this painting out to every single restaurant, every single bar, every single saloon, every single serviceman in the American Army. And by the time we're done with this proposition, we're going to be a much larger brewery." And let me tell you, it worked.
It did.
Anheuser-Busch became one of the largest brewers in the world. At one point in time, they were sending out almost 1 million of these posters. And it has been called the most viewed painting, in American history.
Yes.
And after about, I don't know what it was, I think it was between the wars, in the 1930s, he'd been sending these posters out to everyone and in a fit of philanthropic zeal, Augie Bush said, "You know what, we've got our money's worth out of this painting, let's give it to the 7th Cavalry." And so they shipped it off to the 7th Cavalry, and at that point in time, they were actually based in Fort Bliss, Texas, and they put it up on the wall of their commissary, where it remained until 1946, when the commissary burned to the ground and the painting was lost.
Wow. Oh, I did not know. I know some of the history of that painting. I was on staff at the Autry Museum for several years.
Okay.
And have done a lot of armchair reading about Custer, so much that eventually I got so confused over everything that I only know that a lot of people had a very bad day on June 25th, 1876.
A lot of perspectives on what that was. But in this particular instance, the question becomes, well, did this painting, was it destroyed or was it not? And so in our particular case, the painting, well, you'll have to read the book and find out.
Yeah.
Walled off on his first art heist. And so it'll be something different from anything we've done before.
Brilliant. Craig, with just a couple minutes that we have left, why don't you give folks your website address? they can go there to find out all kinds of stuff. So why don't you give us that, if you would?
Oh, absolutely. You can find me on, I believe I'm on Instagram by UCrossPop25, like that, which is, of course, UCrossPopulation25. And then on Facebook, you can find me. It's Craig Johnson with a blue check mark, official Craig Johnson, like that. And then also there's the font of all knowledge of our website, which is www.craig, C-R-A-I-G-A-L-L-E-N. johnson.com. And, you know, I'm one of those few authors that actually answers his emails. We've actually got an email contact, you know, on our website. And if there are any questions you'd like to ask, you know, about the show or about the upcoming books or anything at all, like, I'm more than happy to respond to folks as best I can. It sometimes takes me a few days or a couple of weeks to get back to people, but I generally answer just about everybody.
Well, this has been so delightful. I can't thank you enough for giving us your time tonight. And
my pleasure.
I'm so looking forward to the next book, and I've got to read Depth of Winter. I'm not sure how I'm going to, you know, we read a book a week for this show, and there's always more books that I want to read than I can get read. But I know Next to Last Stand, I can't wait. So
we
thank you so much, and we look forward to having you on again. Maybe we can figure out how to do that after sometime later this year, before the end of the year, after Next to Last Stand is out. And Craig, thank you so much for what you do for all of us readers, and thank you for sharing, as you did tonight, just wonderful information for writers to think about as they sit down to write their stories. And we just thank you for being with us tonight on the Writer's Block. Do you have a last parting comment you'd like to make?
No, nothing at all. Like, I just would like to say thank you so much. Like, it's a wonderful opportunity for me to be here. It's always a really enjoyable interview. I always have a great time whenever I do this show. Like it, and so
well,
all you have to do is whistle.
Thank
like
you
it, and I'll come running.
All right. So, Ronan, on behalf of Jim, Christina, and the Writer's Block crew, and on behalf of the help that we get with our wonderful station, host station, LA Talk Radio, Ronan, I believe we are, in the words of Jim, Christina, out of here.